So the Trump administration has fast-tracked the permitting process to allow for mining in the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. What should we be thinking about when we think about this story and the potential economic impact, environmental impact, and social impact? Everything. Well, for that, this hour on the Lee Rayburn Show, we're joined by the author of the new book, just out, The Vanishing Earth, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Extraction. And if you've got a question about mining globally, and mining in many different respects, not just oil and not just metals, as the proposal is for the Shawamigan-Nicolet Forest, but also for sand and water, and for that matter, our own mind, you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk at WPR.org. James Crawford is an acclaimed historian, publisher, and broadcaster. His book, Falling Glory, was selected as a Sunday Times must-read and a Book of the Year by The New Statesman and The Independent. The Edge of the Plain, How Borders Make and Break Our World, earned rave reviews in the New York Review of Books and The Washington Post, and was also featured on CNN's Amanpour. He lives in Edinburgh and joins us today with his new book out now, The Vanishing Earth, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Extraction. And James, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lee. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a little bit of your family history and why mining is something that is deeply rooted in your story.
Yeah, so I come from a long family of engineers. My great-great-grandfather was a fisherman who left Scotland actually to emigrate to Canada and then into America. And he crossed the border from Canada into Detroit at the age of 16. And as he crossed the border, he's asked his occupation and he put on the immigration form, he was an engineer. Now, he wasn't an engineer at that point, but he used it as a way to get a job. And the job he got in Detroit was on the assembly line of the Model T Ford. So that started this kind of engineering dynasty, if you like. So my grandfather was an engineer, my father was an engineer, my brother was an engineer, and my father went through lots of different stages of working in extraction. He started off as an apprentice for the British Coal Board, working in coal mining. He then did an engineering degree and went to do copper extraction in Zambia. And then in the 1970s, when oil was found in the North Sea off the coast of Scotland, he moved to take on the job of oil extraction, did that for the next 30 years, and my brother's followed in his footsteps. I am the black sheep in that I'm a writer. I've taken a completely different approach. So in many ways, this book is partly about a reckoning with that, and I guess with the legacy of my father's work and this long history of engineering in my family.
And James, the Vanishing Earth takes us around the world, but you start right here in the United States with a phosphorus mine in Florida. And when you visit these places, you fly over them, you drive through them, you talk to the people impacted by them. This phosphorus mine in Florida, could you paint the picture of us of it for us from the sky and as you look around?
Well, I'll paint it from the ground, first of all, because okay. The interesting thing is it's very hard to see from the ground, which is one of the reasons that I had to get up in an airplane, because Florida is so flat. You know, from the sort of central area, which is known as Bone Valley, where most of the phosphorus mining happens, to the coast by Tampa, there's only about 180 feet in terms of, you know, elevation from the sea to this central plain. So when you're driving around, you just see these kind of high berms, some of which are grass covered, some of which aren't, and they're all behind fencing, so it's very hard to get a good look at them. Then you go up in an aeroplane, and I arrange with a pilot to take me up from a sort of agricultural farming airport where a lot of crop dusters would take off from, and fly me over the mine sites. And once you do that, you get this sense of the incredible scale of earth that is being removed to access the phosphate. And this is phosphate that is used for fertilizer production. You know, the world's biggest fertilizer producer, Mosaic, operates out of Bone Valley in central Florida. So you're gouging up, you know, almost as I describe it, it's almost like a series of giant rib cages in the landscape, a lot of which are filled with wastewater, huge dragline excavators, you know, on a scale that you see gigantic sort of, you know, 10-ton dump trucks beside them that look like toy cars when you're flying over it. And so that's one aspect. And the second aspect, the one that's really staggering, are the mountains of waste which are left behind, because there's nothing to do with the waste that comes from phosphate production and extraction. It creates this thing called phosphogypsum, which is radioactive. It's highly toxic. It's full of chemicals. So you have these gigantic mountains, and there's about 25 of them in the central Florida plain, amounting for 1 billion tons of waste. And the Environmental Protection Agency, when it was originally set up in the United States in the 1970s, didn't come up with a designation for what to do with this phosphogypsum waste, and they still haven't. So what happens is they just keep piling up the waste into these mountains. And with central Florida being so flat, these have become major landscape features. And when you're up in a plane, it's like flying over the pyramids. You know, they're bigger than the pyramids. You know, they're like pyramids, but they're like sort of mesa-like structures. A lot of them very kind of grey and raw. And some of them are in rural areas, but some of them are close by to the city of Tampa. And, you know, there's one that I flew over that entirely overlooks a high school, you know, a high school football pitch. So there's, you know, you get this sense of something that's both immense in the landscape, but also kind of hidden. And there's another hidden aspect that actually a lot of these gigantic mountains of waste are starting to disintegrate, and sinkholes are appearing in them from the wastewater. And that's making its way into the water table in central Florida, and it's making its way into the rivers, and it's resulting in a lot of die-off within the rivers themselves.
Is that why one of the people that you spoke to, James, referred to this area as, and it sounds so interesting, pollution's magic porridge pot.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't know if people know the story. There's a story I know in Scotland. It's obviously porridge related, but it's an old fairy story about a porridge pot that someone sets cooking, and they don't think about the consequences. So it never stops cooking and ends up growing so large that it drowns the town where the porridge pot was set cooking. And that's the thing with these, even when you try and say, empty the wastewater, mm-hmm. what happens is it fills up with rainwater. And of course, you know, you can get, you know, significant amounts of rain in Florida. And the moment the rain lands in these phosphogypsum stacks, it obviously takes on some of the qualities of the radioactive material, the metals, so the water then becomes toxic again. So it's again, how do you deal with that? And the only way you can deal with it is, you know, well, one of the ways they've been dealing with it is pumping it, you know, 1,000 feet down into the aquifer and hoping it doesn't make its way into the water supply, or taking it out and dumping it in the Gulf of Mexico, again, which is resulting in serious impacts on the water quality in the Gulf of Mexico, and significant dead zones that are developing where no life can exist. So you have this pollution problem where you just keep creating it and you've nowhere to put it. And the longer you do that, the more significant the impacts become.
Vern called, couldn't stay with us. He says the environmental impact of lithium mining is enormous, and it's destroying the lives of farmers and poor people in South America, which is something you have learned firsthand, James, in your book, The Vanishing Earth. You fly over Chile's Atacama Desert, you look at the lithium mines there, and you're left with this question about not just the mining and the soil and the metals, but also the water and what becomes of the water, and whether or not is the question that is brine water or not.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the brine that the lithium is in is not exactly water, but it is part of an ecosystem. Oh. And I think that, you know, this is the issue, and things live within that lithium brine. So it's such an interesting and beautiful landscape. This is the Salar de Atacama, the salt flats on the edge of the Atacama Desert, right below the spine of the Andean mountain range. And I guess if you imagine a giant bathtub, and what happens is that whatever precipitation in this part of the world that there is, and there's a lot of snow cover on the top of the Andean rim, which is a volcanic rim. It's also a lot of active volcanoes. And as that snow melts, it runs down into this bathtub, and then this relentless sun evaporates it. And what you get is a huge, really huge accumulation of salt crystals. And within those salt crystals is this kind of all these tiny thread veins of brine. Mm. And lithium mining works by pumping that brine to the surface into a series of gigantic pools, you know, each about the size of 50 football pitches. And then over the course of 16 months, the brine in the pools evaporates and it changes its chemical composition. At the end, you get in this, this starts off bright blue, and at the end, the final pool will be this almost olive green. And that's the lithium that gets taken away for processing that makes its way into the batteries of electric vehicles, the battery of your laptop, your mobile phone. And the brine itself, the, you know, the lithium miners that I talked to, they're saying they're having very limited impact on this ecosystem, but they are using fresh water to flush the pipes that pump out the brine. And you're using fresh water in a place that's 40 years into a mega drought, where there's a very, very fragile ecosystem. There's a number of villages and indigenous people who live on the rim of the Salar de Atacama. And, you know, they are experiencing significant changes to that ecosystem. There's a lot of argument whether that's being caused by the lithium mining, whether it's already being caused by copper mining, because this is one of the world's largest sites of copper mining as well. But they're seeing die-off in their fragile ecosystems. And to go there and to see each village in the Salar de Atacama that's on the rim below these series of volcanoes is like a thread of green in a landscape that otherwise looks like the surface of Mars. So you get a sense of how fragile this all is. But then there's this incredible interconnection between the people and the lithium itself. You know, as one of the villagers who works with and for one of the lithium extraction companies put it to me, lithium is the state for us. Wow. They don't trust the government, but the lithium has given them things. The lithium has given them solar plants rather than diesel generators. They've entered into profit-sharing deals with the lithium miners, which in some respects might help sustain their villages in the short term, but will it in the long term if all of the water is taken away by the process of mining? And that, I think that's the concern. There might be short-term gain for significant long-term loss.
James Crawford, our guest, his new book, The Vanishing Earth, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Extraction. And if you'd like to join our conversation with your questions or your stories about mining, you're welcome at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or give us send us an email to talk@WPR.org. And James, I think of lithium as part of the green energy solution. Lithium batteries replacing our gas-powered cars, lithium in our cell phones that keep us all connected, that this is a necessity, right? But at the same time, when you describe the mines, it also becomes, as one person in Chile put it, pollution is part of our folklore, our tradition.
Yeah, I think that's it's a perfect example of something I talk about a lot in the book, which is a sacrifice zone or a sacrifice landscape. Mm. And it's a really interesting term. This sacrifice zone was actually invented by the American government in the 1970s during the energy crisis, when they were looking at strip mining in the Midwest and the fact that they were going to essentially take over large parts of sort of ranch land or farming land and strip mine it for coal, for energy, because of this energy crisis, the oil crisis. And that might be very difficult to ever return those landscapes to their former agricultural uses, unless you designated them national sacrifice zones, in which case, after you'd used up, destroyed the landscape, got out the coal, you could say it's a national sacrifice zone, and then it would be rehabilitated as a sacrifice zone. It's a very strange, bureaucratic, nicety. Basically, it means you've destroyed a landscape. But you've destroyed it in the service of something bigger. And I guess the pressure that's put on the people in Chile is that this is one of the largest sites of lithium extraction in the world. If you take in the, the neighboring territories of Bolivia and Argentina, something like a third of all the Earth's currently accessible lithium is in these places, and they are being told that this landscape is absolutely necessary for the green transition, and that the removal of this lithium is necessary for the green transition. And in many ways, that is true. But what's the cost of that? Mm. And I suppose the book is, the book doesn't give any easy answers about this, but it does lay bare the nature and extent of the problem. Because, one of the things, one of the people I talked to in Chile who has relatives in America, and she was over at the time of the Super Bowl, and at the halftime advert, there was an advert for, large electric SUVs. And the gist of the advert was like, it's electric now, it can be as big as you want. But obviously, that comes from this landscape in Chile. The more lithium you use, the more you're extracting, the more damage to that landscape. So the idea that we should live within our means with this transition to electric, or this other idea, it's electric now, it can be gigantic, that's the wrong direction, because it's that kind of sense of everything can always be bigger. And the worry that we have moving forward is that actually that sense of infinite growth may not be possible in a finite planet, and we may have to reckon with that.
Let's go to Jack in Madison next. Jack, hi.
Hey, Lee. A couple of thoughts. And first of all, noticing that your guest is from Scotland, I appreciated the Scottish cultural callback with the overflowing porridge analogy. Other than that, as a kid, I remember visiting Pendarvis Historical Site outside of Mineral Point, Wisconsin, where a lot of Cornish people went to become miners and get in on the lead mining trade at the time. And it was just interesting learning about how, I think I was 8 when I went there, that kids who were about my age would first go down to the mines and learn how to dig for lead and then, build up that skill set over time. But one of the things that I just got thinking about was how aware people were of the innate dangers of mining, especially, with a child workforce in that day and age. And to kind of bring it up to the present, is there a more sustainable way of conducting mining in general, one that obviously won't have as, catastrophic ecological repercussions, and that is better for human health in the long run?
Jack, it's a great question, and I don't think there's anybody better to ask who has been around the world and looked for answers to this. And you really don't talk about how directly dangerous mining is to the actual miners who do it that much. You're looking at the aftermath and its impact around the communities that largely are created because of this mining, James Crawford. But did you find a way where mining can be done in an environmentally stable way?
I mean, one of the things I'd say is that one of the reasons my father didn't become a miner was partly because of the dangers of mining, and really interestingly, if you look into the history of mining in Scotland, there was something called coal bonding, which was the workers were bonded to the seams of coal they worked. And if they wanted to try and go, if they were in Scotland and they wanted to go and mine in Cornwall, they would be brought back. It was a form of slavery. And so one of the things that I think for my father, who came from a working class background, moving into oil, was oil actually allowed social mobility in a way that coal mining never did. Nonetheless, and I'm going to come on to answer the question about sustainability in a second, but this is an important point. One of the things I want to emphasize, I'm immensely proud of what my father did, and he worked on oil infrastructure, rig construction, rig design in the North Sea. And this was incredibly pioneering stuff. Some have said it was equivalent to putting men on the moon. The hostile nature of the environment that oil men were working in. So there's something really quite remarkable about that. And I don't agree with the demonization of anyone who works in these extractive industries, because I've talked to a lot of them. I come from a family of them. And a lot of them are just trying to do it to get by, mm-hmm. To put food on their family's table. On the question of sustainable extraction, this is like the holy grail. And a lot, particularly with lithium, actually, it was, you know, there was a sort of senior executive in the lithium mining company that I was talking to who was trying to paint this picture for me that what they're doing in the Atacama Desert is more like farming than extraction. You know, it's using solar power, it's low impact. They're trying to develop a technology called direct lithium extraction, which basically removes the lithium as you pump the water. It's still not proven at any scale. But even then, it is this thing that's a little bit like alchemy. It's like trying to turn base metal into gold. There are a number of other people that I talked to who basically said there is no such thing as sustainable extraction. You cannot do it. You have to find the least damaging way of doing it. And I think one of the key things is you have to bake in the cost. And what has often happened with extraction is the companies that are pioneering it, that are doing it, that are making profits from it, are not paying the knock-on cost. And the knock-on cost is happening increasingly across the entire world now. And of course, one of the major knock-on costs from the burning of fossil fuels is the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And again, we're all feeling that. But the companies that have benefited from it are not paying the cost of it at all. And, you know, I know you've had wildfire smoke in Wisconsin very recently in Madison, you know, so that is starting to bite more and more. That sense of this is happening somewhere else, we are benefiting, it's happening somewhere else, somewhere I can't see, it's happening in the desert in Chile, you know, it's happening in rural central Florida, I can't really see the effects. Increasingly, we are all seeing the effects. You can't turn away. And I think that's one of the critical things that I want to look at in the book. And I think we can try and move towards ideas of how do we do this more sustainably, because we can't switch off extraction. We can't stop it. You know, the world would stop. Right. The civilization we built would stop if we did that. But the way we're doing it is just not sustainable. I mean, that's the key message of the book. None of this is sustainable, and we are seeing all the cracks right now.
I've got a global... James, I'm sorry, I've got a couple of minutes before the break, but just to the idea of environmentally sustainable way to mine, it's you did go look for this, and probably the closest you got was looking at the timber industry in Oslo, Norway.
Yeah, that's right. I went to stay in the tallest all timber building in the world, which is 18 stories high. It's not entirely all timber, but it's about sort of 70%. It has some concrete and some steel in it, largely just to weigh it down, because if you just build with wood, the top floor is a little bit like a crow's nest on a ship, might start to move in the wind. Not there would be any structural problem, but people staying on the upper floors might get seasick, apparently. But if you build with timber, you sequester the carbon and then you replant the trees. And there is vast potential for scale up in certain parts of the world, and particularly in Scandinavia, to build more with timber. And one of the things they rigorously do is test its fire safety. To the extent that one of Norway's main insurance company takes offices on the fifth or sixth floor of this all-timber building. So that's, you know, once you've got the endorsement from insurance, you know you're okay, because they're the hardest people to please. So that's a sustainable way of extracting timber, harvesting it, replanting it, rather than the process of constructing the built environment that we know, which is predominantly concrete and steel, which is an incredibly large emitter. I mean, in fact, the built environment is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases on the planet.
And you also went to the western shores of Greenland to look at the sand mines. As the glaciers recede, there seems to be more sand than ever, but we've used more sand than ever in everything that we've built. And I mean from the cement to the aggregates, the bricks, the asphalt, you name it. Sand is being used everywhere, but at the same time, as you point out in the book, sand is running out. James Crawford, our guest, author of the brand new book, The Vanishing Earth, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Extraction, and we're traveling the world with him and covering some of his experiences and what he saw, who he talked to, and what he learned. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What can we learn from him? You can also send us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News. So there is copper to be found under the Shawamiga-Nicolet National Forest. Should we mine for it? There has been a fast track in the permitting process to allow it. Our guest this hour is James Crawford. He has traveled the world for his new book, The Vanishing Earth, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Extraction. And you're welcome to our conversation this hour about mining at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Luis in Dodgeville next. Luis, hi.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. Just wondering, what you've learned, can you speculate about the future in when, like, if we tap out everything, tap out our resources, what's left? Have we just not discovered it yet? And I'm a little fuzzy on my British history, but I think during the Industrial Revolution, at first it was sourced by timber, and then all the timber got tapped out. And then that's when it switched to coal. And so it seems like humanity has kind of always gone to the brink and then found something new. So just wondering your thoughts on that.
Thank you, Luis. So what happens if we run out of natural resources? And what about this progression of moving through resources as we run through them, James?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we often find, you know, as your caller said, is that, you know, when you're pushed to the brink, we discover something new. And that is testament to the ingenuity of humanity. It may also be luck, and there may be a point where we don't find something new, and who wants to be around when that happens? And that's obviously one of the risks. I mean, I think one of the interesting things that your caller sort of mentioned there and to pick up on, and it was something that I discovered in the course of writing this book that kind of astonished me, actually towards the end of writing it, something I came across, is that last year, we burnt more timber, more coal, and more oil than ever before in human history. Now, we think of a transition. We think of, well, we used to burn wood, and then coal came along, and then we burnt that, and then we moved on to oil. And now we're trying to develop solar, and we're trying to develop wind. But actually, we're just using more and more of everything. Hmm. And I think that's one of the really big concerns here, is that this talk of transition isn't transition, it's actually just accumulation. And, you know, there's something called Jevons paradox, which goes back actually to the British Industrial Revolution and a concern that the coal might run out. And you know, this researcher, Stanley Jevons, is looking into it. And he's saying, well, at what point are we going to run out of coal? And what would happen if we made the steam turbines more efficient so you could get the same energy out of less steam? And the turbines become more efficient. So then what happens? You know, do you use less coal in these turbines? Actually, no, you use more coal to do more with the more efficient turbines. And this is Jevons' paradox, that the more energy you have access to, the more you use. And this is the problem that, I mean, it's one of the things, you know, that doesn't even feature really in the book, is that I wanted to have a whole chapter about nuclear fusion.
Oh.
You know, this idea of fusion technology. And in the end, I made a trip to a sort of prototype fusion plant in Oxford in England, where for a brief time they managed to get the fusion working, and it was so hot. It was about 10 times hotter than our sun. It was the hottest point in the universe for half a millisecond before the plasma kind of broke apart. But the problem is, if you have access to that clean energy, does that solve the problem that we have, or does it create a new problem? Because there's still issues around, you know, population, land, resources, capital, how big we build, where we build, all these sorts of things. So universal clean energy may not be the solution that we actually think it is. And maybe we have to think differently about how we live on the planet, which comes back to that question about sustainability. And how do you live sustainably on Earth? You know, it's one of the things that I begin the book with, and it's a statistic that just blew me away, is that a threshold was crossed in 2020 where the weight of everything that humanity has built came to exceed the weight of all living things on Earth.
What? Could you say that again, please, James? Let me wrap my head around.
In 2020, the weight of everything that we have built and created and made came to exceed the weight of all living things on Earth. So that's plants, animals, biomass, trees, everything. And then you think, okay, that must have been a steady accumulation across all of human civilization since the last ice age. It's been building, it's been building, it's been building, suddenly cross that threshold. That's not the case. At the start of the 20th century, the weight of everything we had made only accounted for 3% of the weight of all living things. The acceleration has happened after the Second World War. It's happened in the last 70 years. So we have put our foot to the pedal in a way like we never have before. And we have taken more out of the earth in the last 50 years than in all the rest of human history combined.
And when you talk about putting the foot on the pedal, I can't help but think of the debate over data centers and their demand for water and electricity, and some speculation from our Public Service Commission here that does our utilities in Wisconsin, that our demand for electricity could rise by as much as 40% in the next 6 years in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I mean, I think data centers is such an interesting thing to talk about. And, you know, I touched on it briefly.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very aware of what's going on in America and how bipartisan the resistance to data centers is. It's like nobody wants it in their backyard. And America has more than any other country in the world. And I think when I was writing the book, and it'll be higher than this, I think it was something in the region of 5-7% of all of the electricity use in the US was for data centers. But that was statistics dating to about 2023, 24. So, you know, 2 years later, it's going to be more significant. You're talking about building some of the biggest data centers on Earth, all of which is both fueling the cloud and fueling AI development. And it's a perfect example, actually, of what I was talking about earlier, of this kind of sacrifice zone, because those towns that are going to have to be near the data centers in some way are being sacrificed for this greater glory, particularly of you know, frontier AI companies. And, you know, the major, major tech companies based out of Silicon Valley, and people don't want them. They don't want them near them. They don't want to be a part of it. And, of course, they are drawing on real world resources. They're drawing on critical minerals and they're drawing on significant amounts of water at a time when, you know, there's drought across various parts of the world and various parts of the US. So, you know, this is where we start to collide against the limits. And it's a really interesting, very current example of why that's a problem.
Luis, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Perry in Oconto next. Hi, Perry.
Yes. As a public landowner, I'm seeing similarities between the Squamanican National Forest and permitting the use of copper mines there, and also how it affected the copper mine in the Boundary Waters, which is sold off to a Chilean company, and we can't even process the copper here. We got to ship it to China for processing. And how has the guests seen, other than voting, make sure we get out and vote for the people that serve us, but how has he seen other countries push back against this destruction of the environment?
Recourse, James.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really interesting case study in Ecuador. You know, Ecuador, which its main product throughout most of its history was banana exports, until Texaco arrived and started drilling the Amazon. And Texaco drilled the Amazon in a way that it wouldn't have been allowed to drill the Amazon, wouldn't have been allowed to have drilled in America. There's something called oil field brine, which when it's brought to the surface, when you drill oil, you have to put back underground. But because there was no environmental regulation in Ecuador, they didn't do that. And they created what was described as a lawyer in a case that put it in a case against Texaco as a rainforest Chernobyl. And that's throughout the 1980s. You have extensive amounts of drilling. And very recently, in 2023, there was a referendum in Ecuador. The whole country voted on whether or not to drill for oil in a protected part of the Amazon National Park in that country. And I think it was 60% of the country voted no, not to drill there. And the constitution of Ecuador has established what are known as rights of nature, so that rivers and forests, mountains, landscapes have their own rights. And I know this is something that is developing in other countries in the world, and there are examples of it in the US itself and in Canada. So that's one recourse, is that the law is in many ways ahead of the politics. And there's a really fascinating, an interesting concept. And I have a background in legal history, because I studied law at university before I became a writer. And there's something called the public trust. And the public trust dates back to the Roman Emperor Justinian. And it's a very simple thing, is that the government shouldn't be allowed to destroy the water, the air, and the soil. And it's baked into the US Constitution. You know, the people who wrote your Constitution were farmers. They understood that very well. And we haven't really been enforcing those rights until now. And climate change and the impacts of extensive mining bring them into sharp focus. So I think that's one recourse, that legal cases are happening all over America right now, which are dealing with his concept of public trust.
Perry, thank you for the call. We'll go to Ernest in Hayward next. Hi, Ernest.
Hi. You know, I've always thought that our tax system is backwards. We prefer taxing income rather than resource depletion and pollution. Al Gore once suggested replacing the payroll tax with a carbon tax. Henry George, in his book Progress and Poverty, went even further when he suggested a single tax on land and natural resources. You know, right now, a natural limitation on data centers is the cost of energy and water, and that is without a carbon tax and without a tax on water withdrawals from high-capacity wells and from the Great Lakes.
Ernest, thank you for the comment. And if we were to tax these companies, would that be passed along to us? Is that an avenue to explore to help protect and sustain our mining and extraction, James?
I think building in the real costs is one initial way of doing it. That if you're going to embark on a new copper mine, what is the environmental cost of that? What is the true environmental cost of that? And is the mining company prepared to pay it? And I think that's a fundamental question that has to be asked of all extraction. And the reality has never really been asked before. The extractors haven't had to pay. They go in, they get the high profit materials, and then they get out. Maybe they sell it on to someone else who's prepared to eke out some profit from the lower grade material, and then they move on again. And I think the absolutely perfect example of that is Butte, Montana. I don't know if you want to talk about that now, Lee, but I think that's such a fascinating story to get into about how this could work going forward.
Well, Butte, Montana would be where the Copper Kings were, right? And this is and where a Superfund site can be found today.
Yeah, it's the largest environmental cleanup site in America. For those who don't know Butte, it was known as the richest hill on Earth. Something like a third of all the copper in America came from there at the start of the 20th century. You know, particularly to electrify the whole nation. Miners from all across the world came. They dug something in the region of 10,000 kilometers of tunnels into this one hill, and the city grew up right on top of the mine. And then you get to the 1950s and copper is not profitable anymore. And the way to eke out what's left of the mine, the choice you have is to make it open cast. So then you demolish the mountain. You make this giant pit in the center of the city. You move entire neighborhoods from the hill down to what's known as the flats, the sort of lower bit of the plain below this copper mountain. Then it becomes so unprofitable that it gets closed, and you've dug so deep below the water table that it fills up with water. And because of the nature of the rocks you've opened up, the water becomes contaminated with heavy metals. And what you have in Butte is a lake that's almost a mile wide, half a mile deep, full of 50 billion gallons of essentially sulfuric acid.
Oh.
What do you do with that is the question. And it's the question that has been asked of Butte for the past 30 years, and they reached a settlement, I think it was in 2023. And the settlement is incredibly interesting because the copper mine was sold by the Anaconda Copper Mining Company, which was owned variously by both the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers. It was sold on to an oil company that had hit it big in the 1980s, who didn't know how to mine. You know, price of copper went through the floor. That oil company was actually bought over by one of the largest oil companies in the world, BP. So all of the liability for this Superfund site, this environmental cleanup site, has fallen on BP. And they've essentially, as part of the settlement, got a blank check to monitor and maintain the water and soil of Butte in perpetuity, forever, because you have to pump and treat the water in the pit, which is known as the Berkeley Pit, forever, because there's no way of stopping it filling up. And you have to monitor the surrounding soil because there's so much copper smelted in Butte on site that people's attics are full of asbestos dust. You know, as one person in Butte said to me, they didn't realize that soil wasn't yellow until they left Butte, you know. And they would ride their BMXs in this kind of yellow moonscape where bones would turn, if like a bird died, its bones would turn blue because of the chemical reaction to the calcium and the copper in the soil. So you could abandon this city, but the people aren't abandoning it. They're turning to repair, and they accept that the repair that has to happen in Butte has to happen forever. There is no alternative. It has to happen forever. The company that is liable for it, not exactly responsible for it, but bought the liability, has to pay for it forever. Now, what does forever look like? That's the question I can't answer. It's a question I pose towards the end of the book. But it's also a way of looking at the whole world, that what we need is that repair mindset for the entire planet. And to look at that in all our different ways, bipartisan, as engineers, people who are activists, people who are writers, people who are miners, we have to look at it in that collective way. And I think Butte's such an interesting model for how that's happening, because the people are not abandoning that city. They're staying and they're trying to change it and make it better, and trying to understand what repair means for them as a way of telling a story they have to tell forever, because they have to hand it on to generation after generation after generation if they're going to stay there. And so there's hope in that, even though the damage is so great.
The quote that I have highlighted here from your book, James Crawford, is, with Butte, and this is what somebody told you, with Butte, it's a remedy, it's not a fix, there is no exit. And that just sort of hung there for me. And I can't stop thinking about it in those terms, and especially when you mentioned some of the wealthiest corporations and some of the wealthiest people having their hands in what became this Superfund site, being able to extract what they could from this Superfund site, make as much money as they could from it, and then, well, the people of Butte, what they're left with is no exit. Linda in Iowa emailed us. She wants to know how much copper and other metals can be found in our landfills. Per ton, she would think our landfills would be more productive than rock. And same with taking from old mines and extraction of other metals, the potential that we could be mining our landfills, James?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of examples of this, of, you know, what are known as urban mines, you know, giant recycling plants that are taking in metals, separating them out. And that circularity, I think, is definitely one of the ways forward. Mm. At the moment, is there money in that? And I think that's the concern. Who's developing those businesses? You know, it's a little bit like the example I traveled to Iceland to look at this concept of carbon capture, which is you remove carbon dioxide from the air and you pump it underground in this kind of pressurized water, like a soda stream, and it hardens into rock. And that decreases the parts per million of carbon dioxide in the air, which is causing the global warming that we're experiencing. Unfortunately, that at the time I visited was the largest carbon capture plant on Earth. It's powered by geothermal energy, so it's a renewable power source. But it only removes the equivalent of 700 cars worth of emissions a year. So, I mean, it's the tiniest drop in the largest ocean. They've actually since opened a bigger, and that which is now the biggest carbon capture plant in the world, just next to the first one, which is 10 times larger. But that's 7,000 cars, and it needs to work with renewable energy. Otherwise, it's part of the problem. But the chief technical officer for the company that developed it, a company called Climeworks, put it to me, cleaning up isn't sexy.
Yeah.
You know, it isn't sexy, it isn't profitable as it stands. And I think that's one of the problems. But we need to clean up. You know, we have to clean up the messes that we are making. And I think that's one example of how we're trying to, but it's at such a small scale that whether it's part of a solution or, you know, something tangential, I'm not sure.
We can't make the entire planet a sacrifice zone. That just doesn't make any sense. The point is well taken. But how does that carbon capture plant compare to just plain trees, James?
Planting trees is simpler and easier. And, you know, and there's to be fair to the company, Climeworks, that developed this, Swiss company, they're very much, we need to do all these different things, all these different methods of carbon capture. I mean, one other example that came from my time in Greenland was something called glacial rock flour. So as the glaciers move through Greenland and they erode the rock and they leave this kind of sediment, almost like a kind of clay, you can spread that over crops. It's like a natural fertilizer. So it gives nutrients that crops need to grow at the same time as binding and removing carbon from the atmosphere. So that's an example of something. If you did that at scale, that would be another part of a solution. But there's no one silver bullet. I think that's the main thing. There is no one silver bullet, apart from perhaps thinking differently.
Yeah,
changing the nature of how we think about our place on the planet, how we think about how our corporations operate, how we think about profit and what we include and don't include, particularly for those who are causing the most damage. I think that factoring that in has got to be a key part of how we move forward.
Karen in Madison called and couldn't stay with us, but she echoes this. She says we need to think of ourselves not as consumers, but as people first, and that we need to think of what we'll pass along to the next generation as a priority.
Yeah, I think it's the notion of stewardship, you know, and I think that's why that story in Butte, which comes at the end of the book, which I didn't necessarily expect I would find what I found. And in a way, I found so much hope in it, so much hope in something that is a sacrifice zone, in some respects, America's largest sacrifice zone, where the damage is both visible and invisible. It's made its way, it's filtered all the way down the sort of tributary river that runs out of Butte, Silverbow Creek, as it's known, which turns into the Clark Fork River, which is a tributary of the Columbia River. You know, there's a danger there that pollutants from historical copper smelting make their way into that river, but they're fighting against that, and they understand this idea of stewardship and what you have to look after. And if we all collectively understand the concept of stewardship, that's a way of moving forward. But at the moment, corporations don't care. And that's the problem, is that doesn't help shareholder, you know, growth.
But corporations aren't people. They wouldn't care. They have priorities. And if we were to make corporations care, we would have to enforce priorities upon them in a way that you wouldn't have to do with a human being that has things like empathy and a long-term understanding of the next generation.
That's right. And in many ways, that's where the rights of nature movement comes from. Because, you know, you have examples of things that are not people that have rights. Corporations have rights, companies have rights. The argument comes, well, why shouldn't a river have rights? You know, why shouldn't a river have rights not to be destroyed? Why shouldn't the salt flat in Chile have a say in whether or not it has to sacrifice itself for the good of humanity? I think all of these are really interesting questions.
And James, we'll have to leave it there with more questions, but your book was fascinating. This hour has been wonderful. I want to thank you for sharing it with us, and I want to encourage folks who are interested in more to go get The Vanishing Earth: Dispatches from the Frontiers of Extraction. James Crawford, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Lee.
James Crawford is an acclaimed historian, publisher, and broadcaster. Again, his book out now, The Vanishing Earth, Dispatches from the Frontiers of Extraction. Thank you for the calls. Ian, I'm sorry we ran out of time for you. Hopefully another time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.